Hello. We are hopefully live now on all the various platforms. I'm David Rovics, and this is another episode of Discussions with David, where I have discussions with folks I would otherwise quite likely be seeing on the road if I were touring like usual. Your questions and comments are always welcome. I can kind of keep an eye on them in between thoughts. These live streamed broadcasts go out on various platforms at the same time: YouTube, Facebook, Periscope, VK, and Twitch. My Twitch channel can also be found at davidrovics.com/quarantine, which is where I also keep songs, podcasts, and other things related to this historical moment. The broadcasts can also be found in audio podcast form if you search for This Week with David Rovics on all the usual podcasting platforms. If you want to support my songwriting, live streaming, and podcasting activities, it's all made possible through crowdfunded support via what I call my CSA or Community Supported Art Program. Those with the means can join at davidrovics.com/subscribe or at patreon.com/davidrovics. Okay, on to today's show. Yesterday, I interviewed Guy Smallman, a journalist, a photojournalist who, when not traveling and taking pictures in Greece or Afghanistan, is home in London, sometimes organizing gigs for people like me and today's guest, Rob Johnson. Rob is another fine, upstanding Englishman who I first met a long time ago. Rob is, in my opinion, one of the very best songwriters on the planet and one of the most prolific ones. If you think I'm obsessed with writing songs about key historical developments of the first half of the 20th century, then you clearly have not yet familiarized yourself with the creative output of Rob Johnson. I'm not going to start listing song titles. He's on the same streaming platforms everyone else is on. Look him up. Rob has been writing, recording, and touring since around the time that punk rock was first born. Because he plays an acoustic guitar most of the time and much of his music is actually fairly quiet, introspective stuff, they often call him a folk musician. While recording dozens of albums full of brilliant songs covering a wide range of topics, Rob also managed to raise two kids and spend several decades working full-time as a teacher. He has recently written a wonderful book published by PM Press called The People's Republic of Neverland, The Child Versus the State. Rob Johnson, welcome to my little show.
Oh, hello. How lovely to be with you in the ether.
In the ether. So
somewhere out there.
Rob, there are a lot of places we could start this conversation, but I would like to start with your new book, which seems more relevant now than ever. Perhaps we've got time. There are some people watching who are at home with young children who have been out of school for weeks now and are really suffering in many ways. And I just wonder if you could share some thoughts about this and maybe any insights you might have for anybody at home with small children right now. I mean, I'm springing this question on you, but I bet it's not the first time that you've thought of this particular scenario. It's been going on for weeks now.
Yeah. I suppose the best thing to remember is that education is like, this is probably heretical, really, but education isn't necessarily what happens in school or what school tells parents they should be doing with their children. I don't know. I always used to think that the opportunity presented by school holidays for interaction with your children was just great. It's more difficult, obviously, if you can't get out and about. But I think that the obviously the best place to start with, whether you're a teacher or a parent, is to talk about what your children are interested in and to explore those interests, to share the children's interests, to share your enthusiasms together. Go where your child goes, because that's your child is ever so wise. Children are really wise, and often know a lot more quickly and a lot better what adults have a trouble kind of identifying. So the great thing is to talk to children and to respect. The great way forward is to respect children's intelligence and follow their interests and share their delight. This is going to sound a bit like a sad old hippie, but I think that a child's capacity for delight is really significant, and it should be our capacity for delight before. And it is until capitalism gets hold of us and chews us up and spits us out as bitter and disappointed. So you've got a great opportunity to share some really quality time, unfortunately in a limited space, with your children. But that's something to be prized and treasured, I think, and seen as an opportunity, not a burden.
Yeah, I know, of course, there's people who are thinking, oh, yeah, well, you try working and
yeah.
but you know, all that aside, I mean, totally, like, I mean, the homeschooling sort of experience that so many people are now suddenly kind of thrown into, you know, having in most cases probably never read a book about homeschooling or unschooling or about any of these kinds of concepts that they may just have never had to kind of think about or just never came across. And now, and I imagine that there's a lot of people sort of imposing an academic structure on their children and trying to make structure out of their children's lives in order to create structure out of their own lives. You know, I'm just guessing what might be going on in a lot of those places, but you would not advocate that form of a so-called education.
I would not advocate that in schools.
Not at all. No, not at home or in school. I just kind of emphasizing what you just were talking about. It's just what they might call child-driven education.
The problem is that most of us, unless we've had the opportunity to look at child development in an objectively, like maybe having some kind of training for it and some kind of experience of working with other people's children, most of us often tend to replicate what we experienced or suffered as children at school on the children that we had, you know, because that was our experience, and we tend to be selective with what we remember. And the worst thing, of course, is if we have bad memories, we think that the education was all about structure and routine and that awful word discipline, rather than process and discovery. If you can't replicate that at home, please don't try. Because for a start off, school's a very different kind of experience, isn't it? Because there are your child has the opportunity to get lost in the collective. And obviously, this is not, you know, teachers are really significant because they can organize the environment and they can intervene, and they should be wise enough to know when to intervene. But for a child, for the child, what's really important is being there and their experience and their friendships and how they relate to other people and how they interpret the world that's presented to them with their peers. So you and also schools have the added advantage of they give children away at 3:30, they send them off home. So that fiction school being some kind of authoritarian regime, you know, that can establish rules and can be quite repressive. At home you don't have that. You just got the delights and the pitfalls of human interaction. And yeah, you're right. Also, like in Britain, occasionally I accidentally catch the television and before I can switch on an old black and white film, you get some kind of ridiculous documentary about how parents are homeschooling their children, and they feature, and everybody who's featured in it tends to have obviously some kind of disposable income, because the children will have massive kind of screens that I could never afford, and the education is often taking place in a nice kitchen with an island in the middle of it. So yeah, you know, like in everything, the less economically secure you are, the more difficult a lot of life is. You have to kind of, but even then, there's nothing, you know, if you can do things with your children, yeah, money helps, but it's not a substitute for interaction. It's the quality of your interaction with your children that's
most important. Yeah, there's just so many levels of the whole question to take on, like in terms of the current moment, of course, like when you're talking about any kind of advice, because I mean, even just advising for parents who are in some kind of a situation where they're economically secure, whether they have work or not, and they're trying to do something with their kids who are no longer in school and are really suffering from the social isolation. I mean, that's... Yeah. You know, in Denmark, you heard about that they're opening up the young children, and it's not like they're over the whole crisis. I mean, they're really dying as well, but they've pretty much got, it seems like in Denmark, like in Germany, they've kind of gotten control of the outbreak, and the first thing they want to do is open up schools for young children, like before anything else. And that's such a Danish move, I think, but it also makes so much sense, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, again, I'm not as secure in my knowledge of American schools, but unfortunately, in the UK, we've had a neoliberal model at school. It's about quantification, and we have a model of education that devalues the informal socializing that children do in school. So. I have a nasty feeling in the UK, when schools open up, they'll be content based. They'll be keen to get children learning and making measurable progress again, rather than providing an environment where children can realise the importance of what is important to them, which is socialisation. And like in Denmark, I saw a head teacher talking about his school being open. And he was saying it's so important that children are with their peers. And that seemed to me to be the aim of reopening schools, that children are with their peers. And that's perfect.
Yeah.
Not that they get do some kind of test and get measured. And you know, I don't know if you guys get that, but my impression is that a lot of teachers in England are being forced to send home work that can be measured and assessed, so that they can tick those boxes of the child is still making measurable cognitive progress. And that's, we know that's bollocks.
Bollocks. I think bollocks is the term, right? You are in England,
That's an educational term, meaning bollocks. Yep. That's bollocks. we don't want schools to replicate that. And so that's something else to be avoided, just thinking that it's all about how you can tip off how many words your child's read. You know?
But then something else about that whole, that like anybody who grew up in a country like in the US anyway, and if they had, I mean, I went to a really cool alternative hippie elementary school, but before that, I went to regular public school, and it was a very traumatizing experience for me when I was young. But this experience in Denmark of the young children in school, and also of teenagers in Denmark, I've noticed like I think for a lot of people who grew up in the US going to school here, they might not even understand the concept of why the people, the politicians and the teachers in Denmark would be talking about how reopening the school to young children is so important, because the social atmosphere for many kids in the schools in the U.S. is often not a healthy atmosphere that's sort of fostered in very competitive and a lot of bullying. Whereas having a lot of time in Denmark, I can say that it's a completely different reality there for both the small children as well as for the teenagers. It's like the kind of emotionally healthy environment that I associate with like a Unitarian summer camp, like from my own social background.
When you get schools that replicate that kind of pattern of competition, and the schools seem to want to pat some children on the head and say, well done, you've won, and then consequently that means you get a whole load of children who think they've lost and think they've failed, and that doesn't create a healthy environment for people to grow up in. You do get that kind of, competition leads to bullying, doesn't it? And it leads to people being picked on and people being othered. We what we want is schools that reflect our community, our community values, and don't just try and replicate the state model of division and competition.
And it really goes back a long way, this whole replicating the state model of competition and all that. You mentioned that in your book too, which is a wonderful book, by the way, for anybody out there who has not yet read it, which is probably most viewers. Not to make any assumptions, you know, if they're all subscribers to PM Press, then maybe they, you know, other people have read it. But you talk a lot about the history of education and how it's been, how it's been created to be what it, you know. One little thing that I remember from reading a book about the history of Japan, that it is a very little known fact, I'm pretty sure you don't come across in your book, but education was made mandatory in Japan after the Tokugawa regime was overthrown in the 1860s. The first thing that the people of Japan did once education was made mandatory was burn down 10% of the schools that had just been built. Because the people of Japan were aware and afraid that this was not going to just mean people are going to learn how to speak English or something. You know, this is going to mean they're going to learn how to be little emperor worshippers, which is exactly what happened. You know, I mean, that was fascinating and very unknown reaction to mandatory schooling. But can you talk a little about the history of mandatory education and public education and how it's been used by the state, what you talk about in your book?
Yeah, I mean, the state education as we know it evolved out of the capitalist class finding itself with a couple of problems at the end of the 19th century. They thought they could use mandatory education to address. First of all, it was seen as a desirable attribute of imperialism. There was the impression that Prussia had managed to unify Germany and to defeat the French because they had mandatory schooling and they had a very efficient state imposition of schooling. So a lot of people thought that if you educated your working class, they would become more efficient in terms of empire. Obviously, that also moved through to making sure that your working class were educated enough to operate the technology you wanted them to operate. So there was that as well, as industry and capitalism evolved, more complicated, became more literate and more numerate. You'd want a workforce that had the basic elements of literacy and numeracy. And of course, the other thing they wanted to avoid was people falling into the hands of other forms of education. You could see it at the end of the 19th century. Working class non-state organized endeavors to educate children, whether it is in Spain transferred over to America with the free schools. But I mean, I've just finished reading about a life of Louise Michel, the heroine of the Commune, and I'd forgotten that she spent most of her life as a teacher. And when her colleagues commented upon her classrooms, they said that her methods were very unorthodox, but also very successful. So you've got all those reasons why the state would want to apply education for the masses that it could control. It was a utilitarian to make the workforce pliant, enabled enough to make a contribution that would further industry and empire, but also educated to support the values of the state. I think the same thing is replicated in America, only the values were not so obviously state. Well, in Britain, obviously, we had the flags and the royal family, so everything was kind of related to the apparent hegemony of the royal family. But in America, the state schools are very, very much focused on competition and making sure that people were good employees, and you'd get the and this awful idea of you could use schooling to filter out the ones that you wanted, to identify possible people who would be able to adopt positions of loyal, subservient workers who could run things at a certain level. And also you could then decide who was going to spend their life cleaning the shit, who was going to spend their life maybe pushing a pen. And it was seen as a way of imposing without too much trouble, as we said earlier, competitive based, but a stratified layer of society sorting out people for their jobs with that old fig leaf of social mobility that, well, if you're a good little doggy, you might get to wag your tail in a suit in an office. And if you're a bad little doggy, then you could just probably die in a gutter, really, because we couldn't use you.
But, you know, speaking of social mobility, one thing that always occurred to me traveling around in Europe is that, like, I mean, I know, like, statistically, the United States has a lower rate of social mobility than pretty much anywhere in Europe, right? Much more rigid class lines here, even though there is a much more of an illusion of social mobility that people have in their minds. But at the same time, like, knowing that that is statistically the case, it's still kind of a little surprising to me to be in places like in Germany, where they have this, or I think by the time people are 12, they're pretty much tracked into either like college track or vocational. I know you're not necessarily expert on the German educational system, but I know you've spent a lot of time in Germany, and I wonder if you have any thoughts on that.
Yes, it's interesting. They do that. I can't remember what is a gymnasium?
Yeah, that's like year 13 or something.
Yeah, right? You get to go. They do selection, and so those children who are deemed to be of more academic, it tends to be academic based, doesn't it? It still tends to be based on academic skills. So those children who are more academic, who the state thinks they can use in an academic way, tend to go to gymnasiums, and the other children go to a different level of schooling. What I would say about the German system is that my impression, and it is only an impression, but my impression is that there are two things. Those who don't get selected to go to the gymnasiums, they aren't as written off educationally. They receive a different kind of education, but there is an intention that they will still have an educational experience. It's just that it's just different.
Mm-hmm.
Our experience in Britain, for example, with the 11 plus, was that those who were selected to go to grammar schools had a very good education, and the 80% who weren't selected, that's the interesting statistic. It's like 20% get cherry picked and 80% don't, and the 80% who didn't get cherry picked received a very unsatisfactory education that often just left them marking time till they reached the school leaving age. And there was a different quality, because Britain's very class-bound, to the kind of education offered. It was seen as a very good thing to go to a grammar school, and you got good teachers, good curriculum, because the grammar schools attempted to replicate those. You know, in England they're called public schools. That's the ones you pay to go to in England, they're private education. And everybody else really just kind of bumbled along and given a kind of unsatisfactory education. Whereas in Germany, I think that my impression is that those who go to the gymnasium for the academic education, they get an academic education. And the ones who don't, they also get a more practical, but also a good quality education. And of course, the other thing is that the German system, it's not modelled on so much on the rigidity of class that in Britain the public schools impose. You know, we've just seen, you go to a public school, that fast tracks you to Oxford, and then learn, you form a government. You know,
you're right.
called you form a government, whether you're David Cameron or Boris Johnson, neither of which should be allowed to run like a cake stall at a village fair without being supervised by a matron. But if you go to Eton, you go to Oxford, it's like a get out of jail card straight the way through. And also, I think that the system falls down, and a selective system falls down like that, because particularly in Britain, since with the neoliberalism of Thatcher, I mean, Thatcher's deliberate aim was to destroy the working class. When I was growing up, my mates who went to the secondary modern schools, they spent their time disliking this education experience. They came out, they got a job. There were guaranteed jobs. The ones who are a bit more able, they tend to work in banks, and the ones who were definitely considered non-able, they worked in kind of more manual kind of service industries. But there was work to go to. What Thatcher did, of course, was completely destroy the idea of there being a working class. So there are no jobs. There are no jobs for the underclass. There's less jobs even for those who seem to do well in the system. But that makes things in Britain particularly difficult, I think, because in Europe, for all its faults, it never has the history of such a rigid class system, I think. And also, there's a kind of functioning society for people to go into once they leave schooling, which is not at all the case here.
Yeah, no doubt. And switching gears to a different but possibly related subject. Last time I think I saw an email from you to your list, you were making plans to go to a lot of those places we're talking about, like Germany, Belgium, I think. That all got canceled. What's been your life like as a non-touring musician in the past few weeks?
Well, it was pretty desperate because one of the consequences is Brexit, and we can talk about how appalling the European Union is and how it's a neoliberal fortress, which is very true. But one of the downsides, consequences of that is obviously, of course, Britain is going to become the 50 whatever state of the USA, and we're not going to be able to go anywhere in Europe as a musician. Part of Brexit is Britain's imposing all these conditions on anybody touring in Britain from abroad. Proof of financial income, proof of gigs, have to buy licenses. So obviously Europe is likely to apply the same restrictions to anybody from the UK wanting to play in Europe. And that's going to be effectively impossible for people like humble people like myself with an acoustic guitar and all the organisation of Irregular Records behind me, that is the cat, he's getting on a bit, to get into Europe. You're going to need to be some kind of big machine with a record company behind you before you can tour Europe. It's just not going to happen. So I was kind of hoping I might be able to have another farewell tour of Germany and a visit to Belgium because, you know how wonderful it is playing in Europe because people are really interested in music, I think. They're really interested in a diversity of music. So I don't think I'm going to be going anywhere ever again. I'm going to be stuck here on stupid island.
And it's sounding a little pessimistic there.
Well, that's the other thing, of course, is that there are less and less, there's less and less live work in the UK. There are less and less venues. Pubs are closing. We have, my experience is that on Europe, people are interested in live music. They go out and listen to live music. And in Britain, a decreasing number of venues, a decreasing independent venues, decreasing opportunities. And one of the things that might be a consequence of this pandemic is that pubs will shut, and pubs with back rooms are, if you like, the kind of bread and butter of the live music venue scene. And once they're gone,
yeah,
the arts centres, no one gets in an arts centre unless you're some kind of posh folk act that, you know, that Radio 4 like, because you sing nice songs about Hey Nonny Nonny the Rural Past and none of that political stuff from you, young man. That's pretty dismal.
No, it's. I mean, there are like. I mean, my experience last time touring Britain is. I mean, there are like sort of some good gigs to do that are still organized by like actual institutions like labor unions. But when it comes to the actual music venues that used to be mainly the gigs that I did, and you know, lots of other people, I mean, the venues just keep shrinking. I mean, like the Islington Folk Club, my favorite one of my 2, 3, 4, 5 favorite folk clubs in London. Actually, I shouldn't say there's a bunch of really good ones. Actually, Walthamstow. But Islington, they shrank. You know, they're like a fourth the size they used to be because they lost their venue, then they lost their next venue, and then this is basically representative of what's happening. The venues are shrinking. So even if there are great organizers and loads of potential audience, they can't fit. They just can't fit. Like, I mean, you know, they can't fit in there.
Yeah, there's the absence of space, and that everything's quite expensive. Pubs are expensive because the rotten pub chains, they charge the pubs loads of money. So it's actually in times of austerity, which we are still enjoying, thank you very much, austerity in the UK, people do genuinely have less money, and pubs being like the record businesses. It seems when in times of austerity, instead of saying okay, we'll just like offer things, we'll reduce our costs to get more people involved, they think no, we'll put prices up, so we'll just make sure we get a guaranteed income. So it costs more to go out. People have less money to go out. They might as well just stay home after having gone down the off license and got six tins of crap Polish lager and sit and watch something on YouTube because it's free.
Yeah, it's free, and there's a lot of stuff out there on the internet, and their rent has probably also just doubled, and their wages didn't double or increase at all if they're living in London.
I read your song to your landlord, open letter to the landlord. Yeah, our expenses keep on year increasing, and our income doesn't, and our utilities cost more
Our landlord raised the rent. Weeks into the pandemic, weeks into the shutdown of the US and much of the world, our landlord raised the rent on schedule, as they do every year, another $75 a month rent increase. But like, of all times to do that, you know, not only did they not lower the rent, not only did they not like, you know, give us an amnesty on rent for the month of April or May or something like many decent landlords are doing, but they actually raised the rent with no comment or anything, you know. And then they sent this follow-up later about like, oh, by the way, if you happen to be one of these people unemployed due to the crisis, here's how you can apply for unemployment benefits. You know, you still owe us the rent, but we're waiving the late fees. The most they could do is waive the late fee in case you are paying late, which they had to do anyway because the state of Oregon has just passed a law waiving late fees for rent and also suspending evictions for 90 days and suspending evictions proceedings. So all they were doing was obeying the law by waiving the late fees, but they made it seem like they're being very generous. But
special people, landlords are special people, aren't they?
They really are. But it seems like, I mean, with all these massive bailouts going on, I mean, you know, just like to move from being a touring musician to macroeconomics for a moment here, Rob, it seems like the capitalism appears to be capable of saving itself. I mean, which I'm shocked, actually. I mean, I was having, you know, anybody watching this might be feeling like these conversations are slightly repetitive because I was talking about the same thing with Guy yesterday. But I'm amazed, actually, that I didn't think any of these, certainly I didn't think the United States could do this, shut down their own economy like that.
Well, it's amazing, isn't it? From our experience in Britain, every time Jeremy Corbyn was talking about, you know, getting rid of austerity as a political choice, and there could be better economic arrangements to benefit the poorest people, you get the Tory, Theresa May will go, there's no such thing as a magic money tree. Well, there's a whole forest of them now, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which shows that, well, what does that show us? I suppose one of the things we could take comfort from is that actually when they say this is how it has to be, we have the evidence that it doesn't have to be this way, and that there can be alternative forms of organization that don't have to be so ruthless and rigorous, that capitalism can be pushed to shift. I mean, it is interesting why they've chosen. I mean, obviously, God, you know, worst case scenario, you know, we had when this started, Boris was chuntering on about herd immunity, which basically meant he was quite happy for several of us to die, well, thousands of us to die, because that would mean that the rest of us will be immune because we developed herd immunity. It's clearly flawed science. I mean, what next? We're going to be returning to leeches, perhaps, Boris. But, you know, at one point it seemed like they were prepared to let loads of us die off because they, perhaps it's because they also knew they didn't have, having underfunded the hospitals for so many years, they knew they didn't have the ventilators, the equipment, let alone the staff to deal with it. Who knows? But it is interesting that they seem to have decided to try and not let us all die off all as once they might well have done. So
yeah, I mean, that's, which is surprising, isn't it? I mean, given the hit, the economic hit they're taking, it's like as bad as the Great Depression. And yeah, we're talking about saving a relatively random selection of people, which ultimately will involve a lot more poor people than anybody else, but clearly also involves rich people, which is probably part of the whole, you know, a big part of the whole equation. But even so, it's still like, I mean, I was telling Guy, and this movie that I recommend anybody should see while they're quarantined is this 2016 Godzilla movie called Shin Godzilla, which is, like the first Godzilla movie, is actually astute, incisive political commentary masquerading as science fiction, and this one is like a very reminiscent of Doctor Strangelove in its sort of the content, although the tone is less overtly, you know, comical. But it is basically about the politicians of various local and state and national level in Tokyo basically having meetings trying to decide the fate of Tokyo and basically, you know, and the fate of Japan. But they're weighing whether they should let the city be destroyed in order to destroy Godzilla, or whether they should allow the entire economy of the country to be shut down while they fight Godzilla in a more targeted way. And they're it's a very close competition between these different views. Like, should we sacrifice the 10 million people of Tokyo in order to save the Japanese economy, or should we not? And in the movie, they were actually more cynical than what apparently appears to be the case in reality, which is that they're not willing to sacrifice Tokyo.
It's strange. I suppose one always has a more pejorative view of your own country, because, I mean, they really are not very nice people, and I wouldn't put anything past them. And Donald Trump, I think, is really not a very nice person. I have the impression that in America there are different levels that are not quite so subsumed by Trumpism. Whereas I find that in Britain, everything is kind of subsumed by the Tories have used this getting Brexit done to assert the control, the illusion of control, and the illusion of a one nation that they have control over quite effectively. And I suppose, again, we're going to come back to comparisons with Europe, but I think there's still a kind of sense of civic responsibility to a lot of the governments of Europe that I think we have had in Britain for a long time. I mean, although it took a lot of effort four cheers from the French people for making Macron give up on his neoliberalism. You know,
right, right. I mean, the yellow vests. What, yeah. Have you been to France since that's been happening?
I managed to go. I managed to, the time before last I was in Paris was just the day after they had the, and completely accidentally, the day after the anniversary. And Paris is all a bit kind of edgy and edgy, but I've kind of managed. Oh no, I was I was in Paris in the 2018. I went on the May Day march, which was really great until the Black Bloc came head on with the CRS, and the CRS were out to make a point, and they just went, "Whoa, off we go!" And so the
You broke up for a second there. The Black Bloc came with what?
Well, the Black Bloc were at the front of the meeting, and they got as far as the McDonald's, which is obviously tempting. And so they set fire to the McDonald's, as you would. But the riot police went, "Yep," because I mean they were just everywhere. They were down every, and they were all kind of tooled up, like they were just waiting. It was like, so March went, "Oh, okay, time to go home." But it's been heartening to see on the. I'm not in favour of violence, but sometimes you can't help but have a warm feeling when you see the riot. In the recent, because again, they're not very nice people. You wouldn't want to spend time in a bar with them, would you? That's kind of
no. And also, the neighborhoods where a lot of the major activities have been in Paris, is just these are neighborhoods that are just dripping with obscene amounts of wealth. They're disgusting places. I mean, other than the architecture, you know.
Yeah, yeah. They always have the nice places, don't they? The rich, they always live in nice places. It's funny,
But Knightsbridge, speaking of such neighborhoods, Knightsbridge, where all those embassies are in London. Wow, that is just, wow. What a neighborhood.
Yeah, you see the fruits of empire, can't you? See what all that nicking things around the world builds you, can't you? It's all immoral. But as I say, Germany, I think Germany's really interesting because... Merkel's quite interesting, and Angela Merkel, a one-time leader of the free world. That's quite a funny idea, wasn't it? But again, I think it's quite significant that she spent her time growing up in the DDR. And there's a kind of instinctive reference point to civil society that when the waves of refugees started coming from Syria, Angela Merkel's first response was, "We can do this. We can do this." You wouldn't get her. You wouldn't get her. The UK government was having to have its arm twisted to take 100 children or whatever it was. And even then reneged on taking the children that it grudgingly promised. It was an ex-Labour MP was now a Lord, who was from the Kinder Transports, who made sure that Britain committed to taking children refugees. And even then, the government reneged on that. Whereas, we can do this. And obviously, that's put a great strain on certain parts of the German idea of self-identity, and it's fueled far-right fuckwits. But far-right fuckwits are kind of easily fueled, aren't they?
Easily fueled, yes. But I mean, certainly Angela Merkel, for a conservative chancellor or of any country, of prime minister, whatever, she will go down in history as one of the more loved ones by humanity.
We can do this. You know, that's almost impressive.
Yeah, so it is.
I think there are those connections to civil society and to sort of certain elements of humanity that
and a guy might counter to that as he did yesterday that Angela Merkel was motivated by having all these skilled workers, which is largely what they got from Syria in the first big wave, which is also true that Germany is a shrinking society and desperately needs more young skilled workers if they want to have those old people taken care of. But this does not negate the fact that they could get those skilled workers from other places, and that this move was a big a really bold move, and there's been a lot of serious consequences. But then it comes at the same time as they're you're freeing up pricing on rent in apartments throughout Germany, which is causing all kinds of problems for Germans to get decent cost of, you know, housing, and at the same time as they have to compete with hundreds of thousands of new residents, which is not helpful for fueling the AfD.
Yeah.
But your first time in when you first went to Germany, was it East Germany that you went to? When you first went there quite a while ago, and you played at the festival.
I went as a teenager. School exchange. It was really hilarious. So this was in 1972, I think. It was the height of the economic miracle. I'd never been anywhere as lavish as the house I was staying in. Everything had a cover on it. The toilet had a cover. The phone had a cover. And it was just everybody was doing so well. It was really nice. It was Mainz, West Germany. So it was really cool. And I went back a couple of years later and I was to work. And that was when it was starting to come apart. And I was working in a bank, and I went to the union meeting. And the union shop steward came down and said, "I'm afraid, I have bad news for you. We might have to be in conflict with the management." And everyone went, "Oh my goodness, oh no." and that was like the Baader-Meinhof. I remember going to Frankfurt. It was the time of the Baader-Meinhof resistance. Everything was really edgy, so I didn't go to the East until 1987, when I went for the East Berlin, just before it all came apart. I like the East, and I've then started playing in the East in Thuringen from about 2000. So I feel I know the East the Aussies quite well. And I enjoyed my time in East Berlin, and I did come away with the conclusion that I thought, on balance, for all its faults, it had a better form of social organisation than the West. I think push came to shove, I'd rather be on that side than on the side I've just come from. This was at the height of Thatcher. She just trashed the miners, and things were kind of, I thought, well, and you know, there was nobody homeless. Everybody had a job. Beer was cheap. There was state-sanctioned rock and roll. But, hey, we get state-sanctioned rock and roll here. It's just sanctioned by corporations. So,
But Thatcher was in solidarity with the East European unions, huh?
Yeah, because they
need unions. They need unions there, unlike the Western privileged workers, which don't need unions.
That's right.
Yeah. But that reminds me of the when Attila was saying when he first Attila the stockbroker when he was first in in Albania where they said that they didn't have any Albanian punk bands because the Albanian youth had nothing to rebel against but they liked the British punk.
I remember Leon Rosselson. Superb. He went to the first political song festival in Berlin, and he kept saying, where are your political songs? And all the well-behaved East German songwriters were saying, we don't need them because we live in the workers' paradise. So
great. So they can, but they must have political songs against the U.S. war in Vietnam
against imperialism. Yes, but there's nothing really we need to protest about here. Because everything's fine. Everything's just tickety-boo.
When you actually are living in the post-Thatcher, post-Reagan era and with the situation as it is, I mean, the idea in places like these lovely cities that, I mean, you know, maybe a lot of the buildings look the same, maybe it's hard, but, you know, to find, like you're in your song Breakfast in Chemnitz, you know, you have to, if you've had enough to drink, you might not know whether you're in Rostock or Chemnitz or Harlow but these post-war cities, but still these really basically nice buildings that had very functional electricity, flush toilets, places for your bedroom and your living room, and they were virtually free to live in. And for anybody who is attempting to live in a closet today in London or Portland or New York or Paris, it makes the GDR seem really like paradise. I mean,
you can't say, in a way, it's part of history you're not allowed to say because of the triumphalism of the post, the post end of history. Of course, everything's wonderful because we all like to think the good guys win, don't we? But because the West triumphed, it must mean the rest was right. So you have lived in a closet, you're homeless. That's your fault, and your story isn't important because we can listen to someone who's got a successful story to tell, which validates the society, which validates that view of history. And it's not often you get awkward people saying, well, actually, maybe there's something to be said for a society with decent housing for everybody. And that kind of, we're going back to talking about schools again, isn't it? I think if we look at the human animal, a little human animal, when it toddles onto the planet, it is as it pretty much is supposed to be. And the human animal, it enjoys a bit of kind of banter and to and fro. And sometimes you can have an argument over scarce resources, like, there's not enough Play-Doh to go around, or I can't play in the sand. But by and large, kids, people want to cooperate. And it's only when we start enforcing competition on people, that's when it goes bad. That's when you get people unhappy. So our experience should tell us that cooperation is a good thing. And a society, and any society based on competition, is just like putting an animal in a cage and poking it with a stick every so often. You're gonna make it unhappy.
And as increasingly histories of that are going further and further back, using soil archaeology and all this kind of stuff, are finding that it, going back at least as far as 60,000 years ago, humans are main strength, the main reason why we are such a dominant species on the planet, which began around that time, is because of our ability to cooperate in large numbers. You know, the ability to cooperate in larger numbers than you can actually know. This is the case of one of the books I've been reading recently. The basic case the guy's making is like, what separated us from other species of human, not to mention other species of animal, but we are now the only species of human around, but there used to be many others, and we are, we existed concurrently. And the other species of humans, at least according to this research, is they never were able to cooperate in groups greater than like 150 people or so, whereas Homo sapiens developed the conceptual ability to conceptualize groups of larger than anything you could ever know on a personal basis, which is what makes us so successful. Which is, a cooperation maybe, once again.
Maybe that's kind of underlying why the state hasn't let herd immunity take its place, because at a certain level we go, this is fucking stupid. And, I mean, I think there's a practical level, because they know if what we're seeing is that society only operates because all these people work together. And at the moment, the people who previously society has denigrated as unskilled, like the people who go and clean the bins, people who drive vans to deliver stuff from Amazon, people who work in hospitals, my next door neighbor John, who's a hospital porter, who every day goes to work, pushes his trolley around all the wards, hasn't got any protection. But people like that, they're really important, because without them, Boris would be dead.
And he admitted it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so they realise that actually, it's something that something that socialism and the labour movement insisted on with growing stridency throughout the 19th century that every child born has immense potential. And, you know, how many, you know, there was that old kind of joke about how many working class children could have played the piano like Rachmaninoff or whatever, but had rickets and denied the opportunity to achieve. So, and society needs the unknown contribution, relies upon a Stephen Hawking's, or relies upon at one level Stephen Hawking's, and on another level my next door neighbour John to go to work and push a trolley around. So we are all necessary, and actually we can't really afford to lose any of us.
Yeah, and we can hope that this might be a moment where a lot more people figure that out. Eh?
I mean, regard to the fact that we are all equal, everybody, nobody is worth more or less.
And the concept of public health kind of is one way to demonstrate that.
Yeah, because I think in the 19th century, the toffs realized that a virus is no respecter of rank. Cholera will go right through your society, given half a chance, and take your knobs with it. And that's a practical.
What did they do then? They started putting in irrigation and running water into London. Yeah, that was a good move. The place really stank before that, I heard. Yeah.
And we better have some kind of elementary public health care, because otherwise it's just bite all of us. That's Dickens's Bleak House. Disease shoots through from the poorest to our heroine Esther Sanderson, and doesn't respect the fact she's a nice middle class girl whatsoever. So.
Oh yeah, everybody should read Dickens, man.
Yeah. We could do. We have to leave the God part aside occasionally, I think, because he can be a bit. But what a great writer, isn't it? Yeah. Lovely, great writer. And he started off and like working in a blacking factory. You know, Dad was a complete financial meltdown, in the debtor's prison, but the guy's got this amazing energy that transforms the novel out of all proportion. So yeah,
Rob Johnson, I want to thank you very much for joining me on this show.
You mate. Thank you,
and
thank
let's
you.
Talk again sometime soon. We'll keep this going. I'll be coming back to you.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
If you don't mind. Hug. You too. All right. Take care, Rob.
Thanks, mate. And you take great care.
Thanks for joining me for this discussion, everybody out there, on whatever platform, with songwriter and author Rob Johnson. You can find his music on the streaming platforms, and you can even get physical CDs without paying for international postage if you live in Europe or the US by ordering them through PM Press, where you can also find Rob's new book, The People's Republic of Neverland, The Child Versus the State. PM Press also put out a fantastic boxed set retrospective of Rob's music called A Reasonable History of Impossible Demands, and other stuff that he did with Leon Rosselson, who he also mentioned, you can find on PM Press's website, their merch store online. And they need your support very much, by the way, because they're not out there selling their books like they normally would be at events, which is where they sell, I think, most of their books. This show will soon be found in the Discussions with David playlist on my YouTube channel for posterity, along with the other episodes I've done so far. They're all also put up as podcasts soon after the live broadcast. You can find them by searching for This Week with David Rovics on any podcasting platform, or by going to davidrovics.com, or by getting the David Rovics mobile app, which you can find for both Android and iOS devices. Tomorrow, I'll be talking with radical historian Maura McNally in Belfast, Ireland. And on Saturday, Margot Black, founder of Portland Tenants United and city council candidate right here in Portland, Oregon. Hope to see you again soon here in the Matrix, and eventually back on the streets.